wish I didn't love you. I do, I wish that I could forget. Could you just not exist?
CKUD, CKUD 90.3 FM.
Fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind, if you're young at heart. You can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh till your dreams fall apart at the seams. And life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth when you're young at heart? For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind when you're young at heart. If you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive out of being alive. And here's the best part, you have a head start if you are among the very young at heart.
Good evening and welcome to Older Women Live on CKUT 90.3 FM. A feminist show from the position of older women, heard this slot from 6 until 7, the second Wednesday of every month. This month, all four members of the Radio Collective met on Zoom to ponder a few events whirling around us. The four of us are Brisna Kajiro, Marlene Ratto, Laura Yaris, and myself, Rosemary Wally. We start with the deaths of two important American feminists, two writers and activists, Barbara Ehrenreich and the lesbian writer and activist Elana Dykewoman. Then we move on to the election in Quebec, where elders, or seniors as they call us, are simply not mentioned. We also have a small item on the residents of Residence Montcarmel downtown, a large apartment complex, who have refused to be turfed out of their apartments because a young outsider came in and bought it with the idea of dramatically increasing the rents and forcing the old people to move. Their determination to stay put is inspiring. We also have a little music and we hope you'll enjoy it. So sit back and enjoy us for the next hour.
Everybody's talking about the death of Queen Elizabeth. And of course, it's a very significant event because she was a fixture in the world for 70 years of her reign, certainly all my life. And as I was saying before, it's a little disconcerting, you know, that like she was always in the background somewhere and now she won't be. And it's a little strange. But there were a lot of other people who died also recently, and we're going to talk about two of them now. So I'd like to start by talking about Elana Dykewoman, who died on August the 7th in the U.S. She was an American Jewish lesbian who was also an author and an activist. She wrote novels, short stories, and she was also the editor for a number of years of a lesbian literary journal called Sinister Wisdom, which is still publishing. I mean, she hasn't been the editor for a long time, but it's still publishing even today. And I have a lot of issues on my own bookshelf, and I have her books on my bookshelf too. Most notable was her book called Beyond the Pale. It was a novel featuring, talking about Jewish lesbians, like back in Russia, like in the late 1800s, and in Kishinev, you know, where they had one of the major pogroms, and then like, you know, immigrating to the States, and it goes right up to the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, and that's where it ends, you know, quite tragically. But it was a really major novel, you know, that was written back in the 90s. I actually interviewed Alana. She came here a couple of times. She was here for the Feminist Book Fair in 88. And then in the 90s, she was here for the to promote her book. It's really an amazing novel. And the last thing that she did was a play. It was her very first theater play. And she herself died at the age of 72. And her partner died about 6 years ago of Lewy body dementia. And her play was called How to Let Your Lover Die. And it was about the whole process of being with her partner and taking care of her through the whole process, you know. And her partner died at the age of 74, about 6 years ago. And the really interesting thing was she died on August the 7th. And the play was going to be read online. And she was looking forward to seeing it, but she was already like very ill. And she was basically in hospice at home. And what happened was about 20 minutes before the performance was supposed to start, that's when she died. So it was really, you know, and so her family was around her and they watched the performance and then they called, you know, the paramedics or whoever, and they took her away. So this was on August the 7th. And, you know, she's somebody that that was well known in the lesbian community, and even among Francophones here in the lesbian community, she was well known among them as well. And she was an activist all her adult life, not just writing, you know, but activism, you know, organizing demonstrations and doing a lot of stuff. And also, what's very interesting is her birth name was actually Alana Nachman. And Rosemary, you might be familiar with that name. Nachman is the name of the grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, who was one of the founders of the Hasidic movement back in Eastern Europe in 17 whatever, I don't remember what year. And so she was a direct descendant of Rabbi Nachman, who was the grandson of the Baal Shem Tov. But she changed her name because she wanted to distance herself from the religious aspects. But she still was very proud to be Jewish, and she still retained a sense of Jewish identity. And so her books deal a lot with Jewish themes as well as with activist themes and lesbian themes. So she was a very interesting character, a very interesting person. And anyway, so I was sad when I heard the news. I didn't know she was that sick. She died of esophageal cancer. And I didn't realize she was that sick. So yeah, so there's going to be like a memorial to her, I think next month, that I'm going to go online about. Anyway, it was an honor to have met her, and I'm proud to have her books on my shelf. And what can I say? You know, COVID sein lichtig non denk, which means basically honor to her brilliant memory. So.
Can you repeat her name again in case listeners would like to look?
Her name is Alana. Elana, right. Dyke woman. She changed her name, Dyke woman. So DYKEWOMON. Right. And she actually joked about it later. I found this out just yesterday that it, you know, she changed it a long time ago, but because she realized later she should have changed it to something a little more Jewish sounding. You know, she would have done that if she'd had it to do over again, I guess. But anyway, but yeah, that's anyway, like I said, she even made the New York Times. Her obituary was in the New York Times. So she, you know, like I said, she was quite a brilliant and well-known activist in the States, and you know, in the lesbian communities all around the world, really. Appreciate
it. Let's move on to the second woman who died very recently, who was probably better known. Another Jewish woman who did wonderful things, Barbara Ehrenreich. And I think that Brisna, you wanted to say something about Barbara Ehrenreich.
I want to, as a tribute to her and to her work, I would like to say a few words. She also died of cancer, breast cancer, and she was a socialist feminist. She was a writer, a columnist, analyst, and she studied the United States Society, and she challenged the American dream by writing about firsthand struggle of living on minimum wage. She is very well known, and she wrote this in her most important book, her most known book, Nickel and Dime. And she also altogether wrote 21 books and got the Lana Literary Award. She just died recently, September the 1st.
Last week, I think.
Yeah.
She was 81.
At the age of 81. So as a tribute to her, I would like to read a couple of quotes by her.
Yes, wonderful business.
So the first one is from her article, What is Socialist Feminism? And I am only going to read two short paragraphs. At some level, perhaps not too well articulated, socialist feminism has been around for a long time. You are a woman in a capitalist society. You get pissed off about the job, the bills, your husband or ex-husband, about the kids, school, the housework, being pretty, not being pretty, being looked at or not being looked at, and either way, not to be listened to, etc. If you think about all these things and how they fit together and what has to be changed, and then you look around for some words to hold all these thoughts together in abbreviated form, you'd almost have to come up with socialist feminism. I want to try to cut through some of the mystery which has grown up around socialist feminism. A logical way to start is to look at socialism and feminism separately. How does a socialist, more precisely a Marxist, look at the world? How does a feminist? To begin with, Marxism and feminism have an important thing in common. They are critical ways of looking at the world. Both rip away popular mythology and common sense, wisdom, and force us to look at experience in a new way. Both seek to understand the world, not in terms of static balances, symmetries, etc., as is conventional social science, but in terms of antagonisms. They lead to conclusions which are jarring and disturbing at the same time that they are liberating. There is no way to have a Marxist or feminist outlook and remain a spectator. To understand the reality laid bare by this analysis is to move into action, to change it. And the second one is from her book, Nickel and Dime. When someone works for less pay than she can live on, when, for example, she goes hungry so that you can eat more cheaply and conveniently, then she has made a great sacrifice for you. She has made you a gift of some part of her abilities, her health, and her life. The working poor, as they are approvingly termed, are in fact the major philanthropists of our society. They neglect their own children so that the children of others will care for. They live in substandard housing so that other homes will be shiny and perfect. They endure privation so that inflation will be low and stock prices high. To be a member of the working poor is to be an anonymous donor, a nameless benefactor to everyone else.
Yeah, she was very, very interesting, Barbara Emmerich.
That was very well put.
A working class background like me, and she worked very hard. She finished with a PhD in immunology or something. She was a scientist.
Yeah, she was.
Yeah, she was. And she was an extremely funny woman. And another thing that I love about Barbara Emmerich, she was not into positive thinking. She thought that positive thinking really held us back. You know, where you, some people, you know, when she first got cancer, she was taught, there's a book that she wrote on breast cancer, which is hilariously funny. I mean, it's serious as well. The way in which women are infantilized by the patriarchal health services, you know, the sort of pink ribbon group. And she talks about the way some women are so paralyzed that they think that they have to think positively. You know, what has happened to me is, great, I got cancer, it's a gift. And she just absolutely dismissed all that nonsense. And she, you know, she just claimed that there was nothing true about it. So she was a realist from, as I say, from a very, very funny woman. Her books, even though she treats serious topics, she's got a great sense of humor. So I would thank you very much for reading that, Bisna. And I would highly recommend that people read all the books by Barbara Emmerich.
Yeah, I agree.
We should spell her last name in case people are not aware. It's E H R E N R E I C H. That's her last
name. Yes, that's right.
And the first name was Barbara.
It wasn't she also the co-author, like way, way back, decades ago? There was a small book called Witches, Midwives, and Nurses. And I think it was a critique of the whole medical profession.
Yeah, yes.
And the way it treats women. You know, it was many, many decades ago. I forgot the name of the other person, the other woman. There were two of them, but she was one of them. That's when I first heard of her, like back in the like late 70s or early 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah, she also worked as an assistant professor at the university, but then she left her position to fully dedicate herself to writing.
To write, yes. And of course, her book, Nickel and Dime, I mean, it tells the story of, 12 months that she worked at these minimum wage jobs. So she
experienced it.
And she was, you know, she did house cleaning. And what else did she do?
She did the waitressing.
She did all those minimum wage jobs. And she, the only time she cheated, she said, was when she got toothache. And so she had to go back to her middle class home for a little while to get some dental care. And then she came back again. So she did live on the $6 an hour or whatever it was. I mean, this was in 2000, I think, or 2002. But the book is absolutely a delight and a real eye-opener. Nickel and Dime by Barbara Emmerich.
The idea that led to this book arose in comparatively sumptuous circumstances. Lewis Lapham, the editor of Harper's, had taken me out for a $30 lunch at some understated French country-style place to discuss future articles I might write for his magazine. I had the salmon and field greens, I think, and was pitching him some ideas having to do with pop culture when the conversation drifted to one of my more familiar themes, poverty. How does anyone live on the wages available to the unskilled? How, in particular, we wondered, were the roughly 4 million women about to be booted into the labor market by welfare reform going to make it on $6 or $7 an hour? Then I said something that I have since had many opportunities to regret. Someone ought to do the old-fashioned kind of journalism. You know, go out there and try it for themselves. I meant someone much younger than myself, some hungry neophyte journalist with time on her hands. But Lapham got this crazy-looking half-smile on his face and ended life as I knew it, for long stretches at least, with the single word, you. The last time anyone had urged me to forsake my normal life for a run-of-the-mill, low-paid job had been in the 70s, when dozens, perhaps hundreds, of 60s radicals started going into the factories to proletarianize themselves and organize the working class in the process. Not this girl. I felt sorry for the parents who had paid college tuition for these blue-collar wannabes, and sorry, too, for the people they intended to uplift. In my own family, the low-wage way of life had never been many degrees of separation away. It was close enough, in any case, to make me treasure the gloriously autonomous, if not always well-paid, writing life.
So that brings us to the next topic. We're still talking about poverty. We're talking about the struggles of ordinary people. And so we're going to talk about the upcoming election here in Quebec on the 3rd of October. And we have five parties running. And their platform was written up the other day on the CBC website. So, you know, what's each party going to do? I don't know, cost of living or childcare or whatever. It was all written up. There was no mention whatsoever of care for the elderly people, the so-called seniors. We were simply not mentioned.
That's particularly reprehensible, you know, given everything that's happened since the pandemic and even before. I mean, with that residence, what was it called? Aéron, la résidence Aéron. And
yeah,
all those deaths that happened, toutes les décès qui sont passés au début de la pandémie, and everything that happened with the Mont Carmel residence and all this stuff. And
condemned when they have that inquiry, strongly condemned by that judge, that Guihan Carmel. She really told it like it was. But what should they be doing that they're not doing? I mean, they should be recognizing that we exist. Apparently now, 20% of the population is over the age of 65. About 10 years ago, it was only 16%. But in the interim, of course, more baby boomers have got to 65 and have retired. So we're now quite a large cohort, but we are ignored in the platform.
We need to find a way to get together and take over.
Well, they do say, you know, they start with childcare. Well, that's very important, childcare. They sort of do it alphabetically, you know, and that cost of living. Now, I mean, you can start right at cost of living, because one of the huge issues for old people, for elders, is not having enough money to live on.
I think that two things are ignored in the platforms presented by the political parties. And one is actually the people our age, and also the health system. That I have to say that COVID was a test to the health system we have, and it collapsed. I mean, the services are terrible. Trying to get an appointment is extremely difficult these days. So it's actually, that needs improvement. So both aspects, the elderly and the health system, not to say that the other areas are perfect, but these are really in a crucial, difficult situation.
Well, it's terrible. I mean, I recently had a smallish fall, you know, with my right finger on my right hand is, well, broken. I've had 2 or 3 x-rays, and I've even had a CAT scan, and I've not got a definitive diagnosis yet. And it's very hard to get an appointment to see anybody. I mean, it really is very, very poor. Maybe if you're seriously sick, it's different. But if you've just got everyday conditions, it's terrible.
Effectivement, on ne peut pas trouver dans les plateformes une place vraiment clairement désignée pour les aînés. Mais on peut, en allant lire un peu plus finement ce qui arrive dans ce qu'ils disent dans leur plateforme, c'est pas parce qu'ils les ont oubliés, mais c'est parce qu'ils les ont englobés. Alors, compte tenu que la population vieillit avec une rapidité très grande, qu'on occupe en tant que personne âgée une place vraiment importante dans la société qui n'est pas reconnue, on aurait aimé vraiment, effectivement, que les partis politiques, dans leur plateforme, présentent un peu plus la situation des aînés. Mais quand ils parlent, par exemple, d'augmenter les frais qu'on accorde aux aînés, là, je sais qu'il y en a qui parlent de 2 000 $ par année, parce que les aînés font généralement partie des personnes pauvres et très pauvres. Quand on parle des soins de santé qui devraient être améliorés, des soins à domicile, des soins des CLSC qui... On parle des CLSC, mais les CLSC sont pratiquement inopérants. Alors, il faudrait les revitaliser. Quand ils parlent de ça, ça regarde un peu les aînés. Quand ils parlent des soins à domicile, c'est définitivement des aînés qu'on parle. Et les aînés, on le sait, ne sont pas enclins à se rendre en CHSLD ou en RPA. Il y a des RPA de luxe où ils peuvent se rendre, mais même dans les RPA privés, il y a des problèmes dont je vous parlerai tout à l'heure. Mais il faut que, quand ils présentent ça, ils ne mettent pas assez d'accent sur le problème. Parce que les aînés sont des laissés pour compte. On a eu des enquêtes là, qui ont démontré combien, au cours de cette pandémie-là, les aînés ont été abandonnés et il y a eu deux enquêtes majeures et on ne voit pas émerger dans les plateformes des partis le souci de répondre aux questions qui ont été posées par ces enquêtes-là et de trouver des solutions. C'est surtout ça que j'ai remarqué. Mais ils en parlent, mais ils en parlent à bas mots, à bas bruit.
Well, I think also, you know, you're talking about the terrible conditions, you know, that old people have, and even if they're in private homes. I mean, you know, like I've got an apartment, I'm sure you have as well. Can you imagine that when we're very, very old, we've got to go into a place where we're 4 people in 1 room? It's absolutely unacceptable. Meanwhile, they're using our money for armaments to send to Ukraine to help kill or I don't know what.
Yeah.
You see, these are our tax dollars. And I think that these connections have simply got to be made, and they're not being made. The media is deliberately holding us by the nose in the other direction, just in case we make the connection.
Yeah, they said it's because they don't have enough personnel. But mais en même temps, ils disent qu'il faut réduire l'immigration. Mais si vous fréquentez les lieux de santé, qui prend soin? Qui prend soin des autres, là? Peut-être au niveau des cadres, on ne trouve pas des personnes issues de l'immigration, mais au niveau de ceux qui lavent, qui soignent, qui font manger, c'est majoritairement des personnes issues de l'immigration. Alors ça, il y a vraiment un non-sens. Un non-sens. Et quand il y en a un, je ne citerai pas son nom parce qu'on n'est pas là pour faire pour pointer aucun parti en particulier. Quand on me dit qu'il faut réduire ça, parce que faire venir des immigrants, ça fait que on a des problèmes de logement et qu'on a des problèmes ça augmente les frais en soins de santé. Je trouve ça épouvantable. Parce que qui soigne? Est-ce qu'on veut venir faire venir les Québécois de souche ne veulent plus faire cette tâche-là? De toute façon, à qui est-ce qu'on va les faire venir comme des travailleurs saisonniers qu'on renvoie quand on n'en a plus besoin?
I mean, the population is aging very quickly, but you know, we're not recognized, and the political parties, like all of them, they're not making any they're not providing any kind of structured plan of how, you know, older people can be recognized and dealt with. And, you know, older people were abandoned during the height of the pandemic, you know, when things were really bad. I mean, not that they're great now, but they were, you know, and, you know, according to several inquiries that were conducted, and, you know, the parties are not making any plans to, like, you know, to do anything definitive about it, anything really structured, you know, and then they're talking about reducing immigration, but we just heard, you know, that this one's mine, you know, that Legault and what he said, you know, they wanted to keep immigration numbers down. But as Marlène was pointing out, you know, we need personnel, like there's a lack of workers, and who are the workers? And this I can say, I experienced myself. I had a 2-month hospitalization. And who were the orderlies that looked after me when I was really helpless? It was basically people from immigrant backgrounds. Absolutely. I would say 90% or more. And even a lot of the nurses, they were from immigrant backgrounds. You know, I didn't have a lot of Québécois de souche employees, you know, helping me and working on the floor when I was there. So this is the thing. You know, it doesn't make a lot of sense. They don't, you know, and when Marlène was asking, so what are we going to do? We're going to import people like to be like seasonal workers, like they do for the agriculture sector, yeah, you know, they import workers and then they send them home at the end of the season, you know.
It's like... And you know, the other thing is that they make it so difficult for professionals, especially in the health sector.
Oh yeah, doctors.
Yeah, they make it so difficult. I mean, to be recognized their studies, and then they could work. And it's saving money to the government of Canada if you get a professional already trained, and then just allow the person to work and give the services to the community.
Well, it's very important to connect it to the militarization of our country. Now, that may be. You know, some people say, oh, yes, but, you know, that the healthcare is in the hands of the province and the militarization is in the hands of the federal. Well, these are arbitrary little divisions. The money is coming out of my pocket and your pocket and everybody else's pockets. So I think it's really important that we make these connections, that all this money is being sent to Ukraine or wherever it happens to be. And look at what's happening now with the nuclear power plants in Ukraine.
I mean, we're all forced to pay taxes, right? We have no choice. And then, but we don't get a say in where that money goes.
Well, technically we do, but in fact we don't. You know, there's no real democracy. We have no real choice. I mean, to have a choice between these five parties, you know, Quebec Solidaire is sort of not too bad. I mean, at least when they're another thing that's really very difficult for old people is housing. And Quebec Solidaire is prepared to, well, they want to build 50,000 houses.
Yeah, and it is the only party that wants to increase the immigration rate. All the other ones want to reduce it.
Yeah, they want to reduce it, yeah.
Did you hear what François Legault was saying? He wants to reduce it so that, you know, Quebec's so-called our values.
Our yeah, because he says Quebecers don't like violence. Yeah. all I have to say is, you know, FLQ. I mean, you know, that was not a pacifist organization.
I mean, more recently, you know, you have that incident in Quebec City with those six Muslim gentlemen being killed. I mean, they're all kind of, it's a very
people are being attacked on the street, you know, coming out of the metro. I mean, Muslim women are being attacked, but Quebecers don't like violence.
I mean, police violence. Yeah, I mean, it's such bullshit. It really is.
Yeah, it is.
C'est une farce.
You're right, but it's very, very offensive as well, because it's very racist.
This party in power now, I mean, they're creating so much more polarization and just reinforcing the prejudices and the racism and you know, that whole outlook, you know, and people are not afraid to come out and say it now. It's like it's okay. And anybody who tries to dissent, they're attacked.
What about the very serious issue of inflation? I mean, this is really touching old people who are living for the most part on that $700, $600 and some dollars a month. You know, they've got their pensions, their federal pension, their, and then they if they're lucky, they've got something from being employed. They've got the QPP, the Quebec Pension Plan. But if they're really super desperate, then they can do the top up. The federal government gives extra money for the top up. But even if you get everything, I think you're on something like $20,000 a year. It's just,
yeah, not much more than that. Not more than that.
It's low.
And you know, with the prices going up, I mean, I think we all see it. I mean, just for basics like food, we all buy food or we all buy groceries, and I mean, we notice. And then you have all these extra fees and charges. Like for people like me who are immunosuppressed, I can't go to the supermarket and buy and go shopping like I used to, you know, mm-hmm. or Beth and I would go to, you know, we get somebody to take us to Costco or something. We can't do that anymore because it's too dangerous, right, mm-hmm. for me health-wise. So we get a lot of things online, which is fine. I mean, we're lucky we can get them, but you have extra delivery charge and you have an assembly fee because somebody has to go and assemble your order. So they charge you for that. And then they charge GST and PST on top of that, right? Because it's the goods and services tax. So you're not just, so even if you don't get it taxed on food, you're still getting taxed on the delivery. You're getting taxed on the assembly, you know, so, and it all adds up. Like, week after week, or let's say you shop like twice a month. I mean, so you're paying so much more. So an older person who's living on just the government pensions, I mean, it takes a huge chunk out of the rest of your budget.
Oh yeah, yeah.
C'est énorme ce que l'inflation nous inflige.
Exactement.
Comme coût supplémentaire. Well, c'est vrai. Les biens essentiels, c'est là qu'on vient nous. Et ce sont les gens qui n'ont pas beaucoup de moyens qui en souffrent plus, la classe moyenne et les plus pauvres, les plus modestes.
Absolutely. Now, even for somebody like me, I mean, I have a public sector pension for which I'm extremely grateful. And because I worked in the public sector, I also managed to, you know, buy a house, et cetera, et cetera. However, now that I'm over 70, I think it's 70 or 75, I get extra tax relief from the government of Quebec. They decide that at a certain point when you're 75, you can no longer shovel the snow and weed the garden and clean your house. So you are allowed to hire somebody for this for which you can get
a tax credit.
Tax credit, thank you.
I think that's what they call it.
A tax credit. Okay, so I have a cleaning lady, but my cleaning lady is undocumented. And I have somebody to do the garden and somebody to do the snow. What the government of Quebec has just written to me about is I have to have receipts. Can you imagine? The kid up the street cleans your snow and you've got to pay and have it. I have to have a receipt. Somebody who's 45 does not have to have a receipt, but I do, you know, so I'm claiming.
Yeah, and none of the parties are really addressing these issues. The party in power is still just trying to promote the French language, and that's it. You know, they're not interested in anything else. Nobody has any really good plans for anything.
Well, Quebec Solidaire is not bad.
They were very supportive in the case of the Mont Carmel residence, the Quebec Solidaire. That was, we got to give them credit for that.
Ils ont supporté une pétition que nous avons envoyée, je pense que une pétition que qu'ils ont présentée pour qu'on change les règles par rapport aux résidences pour aînés, qu'un individu qui achète une résidence pour aînés ne peut pas du jour au lendemain décider de changer les services qui sont donnés normalement dans cette résidence-là, compte tenu qu'il s'agit de personnes âgées, souvent anxieuses, elles peuvent être anxieuses face à des nouvelles propositions qu'on leur fait, surtout si les propositions ce sont des baisses de services.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's a great victory, you see, isn't it? That an individual cannot come along and buy a building that was built for old people and just convert it into something else and charge higher rents. Now, they're not allowed to do that anymore.
Yeah, now the idea is to be constructing, building condos. Because they are very expensive and so
they're profitable, yeah.
Very profitable.
For a small group of people.
Yeah.
That's all you get now is condos everywhere.
Yeah, it's really sad because then people are not appreciated. I mean, what is appreciated is the profits, that's it.
Quelque chose qu'on sent dans certaines plateformes, une volonté de construire des logements abordables, à loyer abordable ou que les gens peuvent acheter de façon, comme par exemple la réduction de l'élimination de la taxe de bienvenue pour une première un premier achat.
Like tweaking it in that way, yes, yeah. But in general, there are whole generations out there now that will never be able to own a house. They'll never have security of housing. Now we all, when I'm looking at it on the screen, all of us have bought our own homes and we're all enjoying the well-being that comes from the security of housing. Now, obviously the houses can burn down or something, but we have the security of housing and we've had it for a long time and we take it for granted. But can you imagine being, I don't know, 32 today and you've got a kid or you're thinking of having children or whatever? There's no way you would be subject to these unscrupulous landlords out there who just keep bumping up the rents and don't care. And apparently what's happening with places that are reasonably priced is that the people that have got those leases are selling them. Can you imagine selling a lease for $3,000, $4,000, $5,000? Because you've got a lease on a place that's 700 and not 950. I mean, it's absurd that we've got to this stage.
Well, the other thing that really concerns me is that there's more and more of these Airbnb, what they call.
That's right.
So, you know, the owners, they have these apartments or they buy the building and then they turn it into these Airbnb. So people who really need housing, like year-round housing, you know, who live in the city, like there's fewer and fewer apartments because, you know, more and more of them are being converted to this Airbnb. You know, which is very profitable for the owners, obviously, but you know, like so many people require housing, and you know they can't. There's nowhere to go because they're all being turned into Airbnbs.
And le gouvernement devrait s'en soucier effectivement parce que les Airbnb là, c'est vraiment une source très certaine de d'enlever une façon d'enlever des immeubles, des appartements du lot des logements locatifs.
Exactement.
What's interesting is that they can check because Airbnb is on the internet. Any government employee can just check where they're being rented and who's right, who owns them and everything, because people are not declaring what they're doing, obviously, the owners. So this can be stopped. Now, I can see that they can't stop, say, I don't know, drug smuggling or something, because it's too under the table. But this thing is perfectly above board, and it's above the table. They just have to click in. And you're right, this was always rental housing.
So where are the political parties on this? I don't think there's one political party in this election that has been talking about this or about housing security, you know, or about clamping down on these owners that are raking in the cash by the fistful. You know, and they're getting away with it. And you know, and a lot of them are doing things under the table. So, you know, the government isn't even getting the tax revenues from a lot of this stuff. And they're not doing anything. You know, we have a friend who lives in a very large high rise in Côte Saint-Luc, no less. And the last time we were able to go and see her, you know, before the pandemic, I mean, every time we went, there would be a lock like on the front door, because there was some, you know, some Airbnb guest was going to come and take it off. And, you know, I mean, this is a residential building. And already there's like all these Airbnbs in her building.
Well, try living on the plateau, Laura. Let me tell you, on my street and the next street and the one after, whole buildings have been turned into Airbnb. And they were all basically fairly modest housing for years and years and years, rental housing.
You know, the same thing again. What are the parties doing about neighborhoods like Mile End, like just like down the street from me here on Bernard? And you have, there were all these like small businesses, you know, that little stores and small restaurants, and then the some new owners bought up all these buildings, and they'd rather just leave them empty. So they charge so much rent that they kicked out the businesses because they couldn't afford to stay. And now, like, we have all these empty storefronts and the buildings are deteriorating. Yeah. And, you know, and the only ones that can afford it are like chains like Lululemon and these, you know, these, yeah, you know, chain places or these trendy restaurants, you know, and the rest of it is all abandoned, and it's like these are perfectly good storefronts. Well, not so perfect now because they've been left to deteriorate. So yeah, they just took the whole character out of the neighborhood, you know.
Yeah, I think the rents are so high. Here, a few blocks away from us, there was a family-owned restaurant, really good food, not expensive, and it's being closed for probably 4 or 5 years, and nobody is renting that building because I think they cannot afford it. So the owner is also losing money there by having it empty. Instead of giving it to a lower price, he would be better and everyone would be better.
That's the way we're thinking. You know, we're old women, let's face it, we're old women. We're not kind of, you know,
candidates,
go-getter capitalists, but the go-getter capitalists, they can go with the government, they can get these loans or gifts or grants or whatever, you see. But we can't do that. We just pay into those funds, but we don't actually see anything.
Exactly.
So when we're talking about this little restaurant or that one, you know, I mean, we would think that would be so nice if they open again or whatever, but we're not really seeing the bigger picture, which is cutthroat capitalism. Now it's got really into the final stages of globalization.
Well, yeah, none of the parties have any kind of overall vision of a better society. You know, they've got little band-aid here and a little band-aid there, like to appease people, but nobody has an overall vision for a better society. And
no vision, and no vision in this election. I don't know who we're going to vote for.
Well, they have a vision, a capitalist vision.
A capitalist vision.
That's what they have.
Yeah, made by the men for the men. Certainly not made for old women like us.
Alors, la résidence, le comité qui lutte contre l'éviction de la résidence Mont-Carmel, dont Suzanne fait partie, et avait invité les supporters à les accompagner le 22 juillet dernier à la Cour supérieure. Parce qu'ils voulaient stopper, parce que le nouveau propriétaire avait enlevé tout ce qui faisait qu'il s'agissait d'une RPA, d'une résidence pour personnes aînées. Il avait enlevé la réception, tout, même des sièges, tout ce qui faisait que les gens pouvaient se sentir dans une résidence pour aînés. Alors que le bail, normalement, finit à la fin du mois de septembre ou d'octobre, je crois. Alors, ils ont fait à la Cour supérieure, ils ont demandé qu'on mette un frein à ça, et c'est ce qu'ils ont obtenu. Oh mon Dieu, je vous ai perdu. C'est ce qu'ils ont obtenu. J'imagine que vous m'entendez encore.
Oui,
on t'entend.
C'est ce qu'ils ont obtenu. Alors, mais le propriétaire n'a pas mis en pratique ce qui avait été dit, ce qui avait été décidé par le juge qui a fait le jugement. Alors, ils ont été obligés de continuer les démarches, et c'est comme ça qu'ils sont allés à la ville de Montréal, qui leur a permis qui a pris une résolution pour dire que dorénavant, on demande à tous les arrondissements de Montréal, et ça devrait aller au-delà de Montréal, que quand une RPA est classée comme telle, ça veut dire qui donne des soins, certains soins, qui donne des services, on ne peut pas changer unilatéralement ce statut-là juste parce qu'il y a un transfert de propriété, de propriétaire. Le changement de propriétaire, surtout que dans cette transaction-là, quand ça a été vendu, il a été très bien indiqué qu'il fallait que le nouveau propriétaire continue à maintenir les services et respecte les baux des personnes qui étaient là. Et je pense qu'ils attendent, je pense que c'est le 19 octobre qu'ils doivent repasser en cours. Probablement, on va y aller encore les soutenir, parce que ça a duré plus longtemps, parce que quand on est arrivé, ils ne pensaient pas qu'il allait y avoir 80 personnes pour soutenir ce groupe-là. Alors, on n'avait pas une salle qui pouvait nous prendre tout ce monde-là. Et finalement, on a dû faire des démarches pour changer de salle, pour avoir une plus grande salle. Et même avec la plus grande salle, on était tassés pas mal. Mais ça a été vraiment, ça a donné une très bonne impression. Mais c'est bizarre d'entendre les avocats, bien sûr, les avocats qui défendaient la cause du côté du nouveau propriétaire.
Qui a maintenant, là, c'est incroyable, ce nouveau propriétaire.
Ils avaient des arguments là, assez extraordinaires. Et là, on était là, mais est-ce qu'ils pensent que ces gens-là qui occupent cette résidence-là, il s'agit de personnes et non d'objets?
Oui, c'est une arrogance très profonde. Ah, oui. Ce jeune-là, il a, je pense, 28 ans, c'est un des classes de prédateurs. Il y a beaucoup maintenant dans oui. cette groupe-là, des prédateurs qui vont tout saisir, qui vont faire de l'argent là, sur des affaires tellement de base, comme des logements, des abris pour des gens. Ils s'en foutent.
Alors, la situation, c'est pas réglé d'une manière permanente encore.
Non.
Les résidents ne sont pas vraiment en sécurité.
Pas du tout. pas du tout. Ils attendent le 19 octobre, je pense. On va les entendre sur le fond. Là, il fallait stopper les changements que le propriétaire faisait. Mais même ça, on n'a pas réussi parce qu'il a continué comme si de rien n'était. Mais au moins, il y a un ordre. Et on a demandé au CIUS aussi de faire respecter les règles. Je ne sais pas si le CIUS le fait véritablement, mais en attendant, il faut une autre session sur le fond au tribunal pour voir qu'est-ce qui va en sortir. On espère que ça va être bon et que ça sera bon pour toutes les RPA. Parce que c'est une chose qui menace toutes les résidences pour personnes aînées.
Ah oui, pas juste le Mont-Carmel.
Pas juste le Mont-Carmel.
It has implications for all the residences.
Yes, yes.
You know.
No, because we have to.
Well, we have to allow for the theme song and the intro and maybe one or two musical breaks, you know. So I think, you know.
Okay.
So we're probably. I mean, if you want, I can summarize a little bit what Marlène said about the Mont-Carmel, if we have room to put it in. We had a feature on it on Older Women Live a few months back with Marlène and Suzanne Loisel and another woman, I can't remember her name right now.
Manon Marseille.
And there was, so the committee that was...
C'est ça.
And so the committee that was fighting for the Mont-Carmel residents with the help of Quebec Solidaire and some legal counsel. And they finally went to the Superior Court. And in the meantime, the new landlord has been taking away more and more services. And I know he's been renting to like young people with kids and all kinds of stuff if anybody moves out, and like really trying to change the vocation of the building from a building with services for older people to become a regular building and you know, get more rent, obviously jacking up the rent. And then even though a judge had said that, you know, he should stop, you know, this has to stop while things get resolved, but the landlord didn't implement any of the recommendations that the judge had recommended. And they went to the city, and you know, the thing is, so now, on the 19th of October, the residents have to go back to court. And the point being that to put a stop to this, in other words, not just for this one building, but in general, to put a stop to this so that a building that's already been designated as a building with services for older people, that they can't just change it, you know, from one day to the next and become a regular apartment building and jack up the rent and take away the services that these older people have been counting on. And that's why they moved into these buildings in the first place, obviously. So, and also that Marlène was saying there was a lot of support, like the residence committee, there was like 90 people or something, and they had to keep getting bigger and bigger rooms in order to conduct the hearing. So it kind of makes an impression too on the officials, because they can see that there's a lot of people that are supporting these residents, and that the residents themselves are fighting back, and they're trying to fight against this, you know, basically it's capitalist greed again. So I guess on the 19th of October, there's going to be another court session to with the ultimate goal of making sure that no designated apartment buildings that are designated as residences for older persons with services are just going to be instantly converted every time there's a change in ownership to become regular buildings and get the rent jacked up. So I guess the thing is that the people in Mont-Carmel, for example, they've gotten a reprieve of maybe, you know, a few months, but they're still not, it's not a permanent solution until we can get something in place that's going to stop this kind of thing from happening.
And that would presumably be at the level of the government of Quebec. They would have to change the law.
Well, yeah, they'd have to change the laws.
Yeah.
They have to change the law. C'est pourquoi on avait une pétition pour demander au gouvernement du Québec de changer la loi.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a petition. I remember we all signed it. Mm-hmm. It was a petition, a National Assembly petition, I remember we talked about it at the during that show a few months back. And
if your last vaccination against COVID-19 was more than 5 months ago, it's time to get another dose. Boosting your antibodies reduces the risk of getting or transmitting the virus. And booster doses help reduce the number of hospitalizations and deaths related to COVID-19. For better protection against the virus, book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine and follow the recommended vaccination schedule. Vaccination against COVID-19, a good way of extending our protection. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening, good day. Welcome to Amanda here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, your show, 1 hour show on African current affairs. I am sitting here virtually with Doug. Doug, what do you have lined up for us tonight? Well,
Raj Kanji, our good friend and comrade in New Brunswick, introduced me to the work of the late Dan Matera, who passed away in early July. And he was a very important activist, poet, journalist in South Africa. From the 50s on, he was very, very busy man and involved in politics at so many levels. And when he passed away, Raj got in touch with his son. They had set up a Dan Matera Legacy Foundation. And so that's what we're going to hear tonight, is an interview with Raj and Dr. Teddy Matera, Don's son. And it's a wonderful insight into a historical period, into the confluence of art and activism and also a comment on the current society of South Africa. So Raj and Don will go through that. And they're going to talk about